Blog Talk Radio.
From the case files of God's Gumshoe. Case 606. Codename Ichabod.
Dear God's Gumshoe, my name is Ichabod. I'm a 14-year-old young man who is interested in finding the truth. I am told that God wrote a book called the Bible, and that this is the foundation document for the whole of Western civilization. I'm also told that it is without error that every word of it is true, and that I should read it. But while I see that there are great truths within this book, there are also things that cannot possibly be true, and stories that tell the same event but are completely different. How can this be? Can you tell me how this book came about and who actually wrote this book? Thank you. Oh, I might have another question later. Ichabod.
Once again, thank you, Ichabod. To pursue our subject a little further and a little deeper now, what we want to do is we want to go and investigate the times in which Jesus lived and delivered his teachings. So we want to further explore the culture and the traditions of the day. What were the elements of the culture? What were the elements of the religious beliefs and thoughts? What was going on in his day? It's very difficult for us to view that time through our window or our perspective. It's much like the idea of looking through the world with rose-tinted glasses. You see the world tinted to what those glasses are. Well, it's very much the same for 21st century people to look back at the first century or earlier and try to get a picture of what was actually happening on those days. So today we're going to explore the times of Jesus, the times before, the pre-existing times, the situation that led up to Jesus' life, his teachings, and his death and crucifixion. So in order to do that, we need to know a number of things. First of all, what was the political situation of the day? How did it get like that? What was the religious situation of the day? How did it get like that? What was the belief in that day, particularly the Messiah, but also the beliefs and the ideas around who and what the Romans were and what the Greek culture had done to the area, and the pre-existing times before that even. So let us begin with that. Let us begin with pre-existing situations. The majority of Christians will believe that Jesus had a pre-existence, that the biblical argument for the pre-existence of Jesus is certainly there in the Bible and multifaceted. Pre-existence is defined as existing in a former state or a previous life, and in the case of Jesus, his pre-existence means that before he became a man and walked upon the earth, he existed in another arena, another dimension. The Bible not only explicitly teaches this doctrine, but implies this fact at various points throughout the Gospels and the Epistles. In addition, Jesus' own actions reveal his divinity, his divine identity, as a result of his pre-existence, that he was there because he had a pre-existence. Several places in the New Testament explicitly teach Jesus' pre-existence. Jesus said, "And now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory I had with you before the world began," John 17. This passage alone is sufficient to show that the scripture supports Jesus' pre-existence, but it is just one of the many passages throughout the Bible. Jesus himself explicitly taught, according to the Bible, his own pre-existence in John 3, John 6, John 16, in many places. Christ even said that he existed prior to Abraham's birth. In John 8, even though Abraham's birth precedes Jesus' own birth by many centuries, still he said, "Before Abraham was, I was." Several texts present Jesus as pre-existing with his Father, such as in Romans 8, 1 John, and Galatians. And several passages identify Jesus as the Creator. And this is particularly important in John 1, verses 2 and 3, Colossians 1, 16 and 17, and Hebrews 1, 2. The idea as Jesus as creator of this universe is an important element, as we'll see in a minute. Probably the most powerful evidence for the pre-existence of Jesus was the very behavior of Jesus himself. He was often doing and saying things that only the God of Israel had the right or the power to do. For instance, Jesus' healing of the paralytic in Mark 2 was done to demonstrate his authority and his ability to forgive sins. Jesus' Jewish audience was well aware that such actions were reserved only for Yahweh, the name of their God. And Jesus' actions in Luke 7 drew a particular and similar reaction to this. So Jesus was always getting into trouble by declaring the authority with which he was doing things. He was either doing it in his own authority or the authority of the Father who had sent him, or he who had sent him gave him the authority. That Jesus pre-existent in his divinity is further proven by his being the object of worship repeatedly in the Gospels. Matthew 28, Luke 24, John 9, they're constantly talking about the worship of Jesus. Never did Jesus reject such adoration. He saw such worship as entirely appropriate. Jesus implied that he had this authority and that he had the authority even over the Sabbath, as in Mark 2, verses 26-28, as well as the authority to abolish certain law, as in Ephesians 2. Such behavior is sheer blasphemy coming from anyone short of divine, and this was the Jewish argument. In addition, Jesus identified himself in the Bible as the divine Son of Man in Mark 14, and he claimed to be able to raise himself from the dead in John 10. This turned out to be the very miracle that he claimed would authenticate his radical claims and his ministry. Jesus accompanied this grand miracle and gave convincing proof of it in Luke, John, and in Acts. This miracle establishes Jesus' claim to deity and thus proves further confirmation of his pre-existence. Now this, of course, is the Christian perspective as viewed from the Bible. The scholar's perspective, other than theologians, but generally historians, really don't have a position about that. But the Urantia papers do, and it centers around the idea of the Archangel Michael. Many Christians believe that Jesus' pre-existence, who Jesus was before he came to this planet and walked as a man, was as the Archangel Michael. This belief is held by many Christian denominations and different sects within Christendom. The Urantia papers hold a similar view, but they place Jesus on a higher level than an archangel, and hence we go back to the idea of the Creator. The Urantia papers say that God, the center of the universe, the source of all creation, the pure energy system that created the whole of the universe, and the pure spirit energy that passes the whole mind-spirit-gravity circuits through the material universe, created the center and perfect universe, and then established creator sons, called Michaels, who would then go out and create their own material universe based on the model that the Father had set. The Father's is paradise. Each of the Creator's Son is to bring a time-space universe up to the equivalency. According to the Urantia papers, Jesus was one such Michael, and that he had created this section of the universe, of this time-space universe, and in order to gain the full administration, or the sovereignty of it, if you like, he needed to pass through a number of experiences or tests, if you like, seven of which involved him downstepping himself into one of the beings that were active in his universe. For instance, he would step down to become an archangel, step down further, become an angel, step down again to become a Melchizedek, which, by the way, was why it's mentioned in the book of Hebrews that Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek, because in a pre-existent life, Jesus was a Melchizedek. The final and seventh step, or the seventh bestowal, was to be as a human being, and in this particular case, as a baby. He chose this planet because of the difficulties that were prevalent in his universe at the time. While he was preparing all of this, one of his high angels, named Lucifer, rebelled. And we'll discuss this further on down the line and later on. But this rebellion caused shockwaves through this section of the universe. And our planet in particular was immensely influenced. It was thrown off kilter, thrown off the divine plan, and everything basically ran amok. The Urantia papers tell us that both creationists and evolutionists are right in that God, in this case Michael, Son of God, creates the universe, and evolution is the process through which they bring it from the muck and the mire of the material universe up to the perfected spiritual universe. In this process, we ran into a number of speed bumps. One of them was that at a particular point in evolution, the genetic material that we use, the genetic gene pool, gets exhausted, and it requires a biological upliftment. And that's when beings come from the spiritual dimension to our dimension with a program to biologically uplift our planet. The name of those beings, the male and the female, is Adam and Eve. Ours arrived, began their process, and because of this Lucifer rebellion, they defaulted. That's the story, according to the Urantia papers, of what actually happened. It's deeper than this, and we'll discuss it much more later on. In order to understand that better, what we're told was that as soon as it was discovered that our biological uplifters defaulted, our Adam and Eve fell through the cracks, that was when Michael decided that our planet was to be the choice of his incarnation as a babe, his seventh bestowal. So, you can imagine, back about 38,000 years ago, all of a sudden, all of our planetary administration, all of the angels and archangels who were working on our planet, all of a sudden heard, the boss is coming, get busy. And a number of things got put into place. A number of situations were supported and arrived at. One of which was the meeting of a Melchizedek, who came from the other side, to help to establish a monotheistic religious faith in which Michael could be born into, and of course influenced and talked with Abraham. Second, and at about 600 BC, something amazing happened to our planet, and we call it the Axial Age. At 600 BC, it looks as though something came through the consciousness circuits of our world that changed everything for all time, everywhere. The Greek rational philosophical ideas, mathematics, and science were born in Greece. In China, the great political and philosophical movements of China rose up. Confucius was born. Lao Tzu, who was the founder of Taoism. In India, the Upanishads were written. The Rig Vedas were put together. Buddha was born. In the Middle East, monotheism was born. The Jewish people were comforted in exile in Babylon. The Old Testament was written. In and around the New World, the Mayan calendar was brought from Mexico and coalesced into a calendar that looked back 2,500 years and looked forward 2,500 years. This whole Axial Age began something absolutely incredible. But more than anything, it prepared the Hebrew people, the Jewish nation, to move from Babylon back to Israel, rebuild their temple, and launch the first of the great monotheistic religions on our planet, which then prepared the way for the Creator's Son, Michael, to be born into and to bring his teachings and his new ideas in the upliftment of the idea of God and what that means to the people of our planet. It was not just for one people, it was for all. And as the Bible tells us many times, it's not for just the Jewish people, for Jew and Gentile alike, for every man, woman, and child on this planet. So with that, let us begin, and let us begin in and around the Axial Age, because this is a pivotal moment in understanding why the whole of the culture was prepared for certain ideas, certain belief systems, certain concepts of the Messiah, of the Jewish faith, the Jewish religion, why Jesus, Michael, chose the Jewish faith to be born into and to conduct his mission. By starting at the Axial Age, we'll be able to develop the thought pattern, the culture, and the process beginning in and around the Greeks and spreading through the Mediterranean world and laying the groundwork and the foundation for the Roman Empire. This is the world that Jesus was born into. This is the world he was educated into. This is the world where he conducted his mission, taught his teachings, taught his disciples, taught the people of Israel, was captured, crucified, and laid the foundations for the whole of the Christian faith as it is outlined in the Bible, and hence our investigation of that. So, we'll begin now with the discussion of the Axial Age. I present now Professor Karen Armstrong, a very well-known speaker on this subject, teacher, educator, author, very prominent in this discussion. Professor Armstrong, if you will please.
We cannot be religious in the same way as our ancestors. We live in an entirely transformed world, and old ideas and practices which nourished our forefathers often seem drained of meaning, and can even become sort of repellent or perplexing to us in our modern scientific rationalistic age. But the idea of a reformation is not a new one. It should be happening all the time. Religions cannot stand still. Otherwise, if they cannot adapt to their particular modernity, they will become obsolete and fade away. And so each tradition represents a dialogue between a transcendent reality on the one hand and the shifting and constantly distressing events in the world here below. And each generation has the responsibility of looking creatively at its past, at its roots, and making that tradition speak to its unique present, to answer those particular dilemmas, to answer those particular questions that are thrown up at that moment of history. But that doesn't mean we must be imprisoned in the past. And very often when people talk about Reformation, a sort of tinkering goes on. People sort of try to alter a little doctrine here or there, or turn a little knob, or just try to make some slight alteration, and with some mental sleights of hand and intellectual fancy footwork, try to produce something that has some continuity with sacred tradition. And it's really strange that in our world, which is essentially an age of constant innovation and constant invention, constantly we are exposed to novelty. We have institutionalized change in our society as no other society has ever done before. And yet in religion we are so timorous about change. And maybe it's a reaction. But tonight, when I'm looking back to the past, I know this may sound an anomaly at the Jesus seminar, I'm going to go back beyond Jesus. To the Axial Age. You heard about it this morning from Lloyd Gearing. It's the period of history from about 800 to 200 BCE when all the great world religions that have continued to nourish human beings came into existence. Buddhism and Hinduism in the Indian subcontinent, Confucianism and Taoism in China, monotheism in the Middle East, and rationalism in Europe, Greek rationalism. I think it's important to look back at the origins of faith, not just out of an antiquarian curiosity, but because I think these people are often quite shocking to us, and in a very healthy way. They can challenge some of our religious preconceptions and make us rethink things.
Your most recent book deals with a period that's been referred to as the Axial Age, and it's a time that coincides with the development of some of the most important religious and philosophical thinking that still resonates to this day. Tell us about this period, what was going on, and why it is important today.
Well, from about 900 to 200 BC, all the major world traditions that have continued to nourish humanity either came into being or had their roots in four distinct regions of the world. So you have Confucianism and Taoism in China, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism in India, monotheism in Israel. Yes, and all these faiths, despite interesting differences, shared a remarkably common perspective. One of the factors that helped to produce the Axial Age was an increase in violence. These regions were torn apart, rent apart with violence on an absolutely unprecedented scale. Iron weaponry had been developed, and that meant that wars became far more deadly and frightening. Big, large, coercive states developed, which depended upon coercion and a huge army and a police force. We have the beginnings of a market economy, so an aggressive capitalism is beginning. And in every case, I found the catalyst for religious change in each of these regions was a revulsion from that violence, a disciplined determination to look in the human psyche for the root causes of that violence and then seek to find an alternative way. And they're not interested in doctrines or metaphysics at all. We often today associate religion with believing things. In fact,
rules.
Believing, orthodoxy. Right. We often call religious people believers, as though accepting certain creedal propositions was the main thing that they do. But none of the axial sages, the prophets of Israel, Buddha, Confucius, were at all interested in metaphysics, in who created the world, or was there proofs for the existence of God. Many of them thought this kind of speculation was fascinating, but a distraction. A distraction from the real quest, which was behaving
right
in a different way that would change you, transform you indeed, at a profound level. They all found that that you needed to divest yourself to get rid of egotism, of greed, hatred, envy. And the safest way of doing that was by the exercise of compassion. And compassion was the key to all these faiths. It was the main prop of what they were trying to do. In compassion, you dethrone yourself from the center of your world and you put another there. It's the safest way of getting rid of egotism. And indeed, later, rabbinic Judaism, Christianity, and Islam would repeat the Axial Age experience, and they too would put compassion and loving kindness at the heart
of their
vision.
Yeah, I want to talk about that both specifically. The Golden Rule.
Yes.
Again, linking these four trains of thought.
The first person to enunciate the Golden Rule, do not do to others as he would not have done to you, as far as we know, was Confucius,
mm-hmm,
about 500 years before Christ. His disciples asked him what was the single thread that ran through all his teaching, that pooled it all together. And he said, do not do to others as he would not have done to you. This, he said, was his religion. Religion was inseparable from altruism. His disciples asked him, which one of your teachings can we put into practice all day and every day? And he replied, don't do to others what you would not have done to you.
And this same sentiment, though, finds its way through all
the things. Absolutely. The Buddha had his own version of this. And, of course, later on, in the monotheistic traditions, St. Paul would say you can have faith that moves mountains, but if you lack charity, it's worth nothing.
A quest for enlightenment also as part of this joining theme.
The idea of enlightenment, it's not to get the kind of knowledge which is essentially information. It is an awakening. One of the great insights of the Axial Age was that the ultimate reality, whether you call that God or Brahman, Nirvana or the Tao, was not just something remote out there. It was also identical with the deepest core of your being.
You've written about this before, but in the Great Transformation, you write at length about the common roots of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, three great religions today that we see as markedly different. Talk to me about those common origins and the common thinking and the three monotheistic...
All three of the religions, of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, as we have them today, are rooted in Axial Age Israel, all three. Israel's Axial Age was actually truncated. It came to an end rapidly because of the vicissitudes of Middle Eastern politics, and it fizzled out early. But it had a wonderful revival in another time of violence in the first century, when Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, both at a time when the Temple and Jerusalem were destroyed yet again, and the people lost their land. This evolved an entirely new way, two new ways of being Jewish, Rabbinic Judaism, Christianity, but both putting a central importance upon compassion and charity and loving kindness is the great teaching of the law. Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, was approached by a pagan who promised to convert to Judaism while the rabbi stood, if the rabbi could recite the whole of Jewish teaching while he stood on one leg. Mm-hmm. And Hillel stood on one leg and spouted the golden rule. He said, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it. Jesus taught a version of the golden rule. And of course you have St. Paul's famous hymn to charity, which shows how charity and loving kindness knocks out egotism. Charity is patient. It's not puffed up. It doesn't take offense, all those bristly parts of our egotism. So there's a clear line. Now, Islam, very definitely, Muhammad had never heard of the Axial Age, of course, but he would have recognized and understood the concept, because the Quran makes it quite clear over and over again that Islam is not a new religion. It is simply repeating what the great prophets of the past, starting with Adam, Noah, Abraham, King David, Solomon, Jesus, all had all taught that life had to be filled with practical compassion.
Given that common beginning and common theme, I mean, it begs the obvious question, kind of what happened along the way when so much of these religions, especially in the news today, are associated with orthodoxy and dogma and prescription?
Well, you see, I don't think compassion's a really very popular virtue. When I go around talking about compassion, I see people sometimes looking rather mutinous and balked. What's the fun of being religious if you can't hate or disapprove of other people? And people often get quite a buzz. Often religious people prefer to be right rather than compassionate. And over the years, therefore, people have shielded themselves from the extreme demands of compassion. It's not easy. We know that. We are people who love to hate. Or love to disapprove, or who feel ourselves enhanced by denigrating others. All these faiths have, over the years, accumulated secondary goals and put them in first place, like orthodox dogma, my faith is better than yours.
Why? Why did we lose that axial ethos that you talk about?
Because, as I say, people really don't...
It's hard work.
Yes, and people really want religion to enhance their egotism, to give them a greater sense of themselves. They don't really want to be transformed at base.
Yeah, but at the end of the book, you're calling for a return.
We've got to do it.
What does that look like? How would that happen?
Basically, I think that this is the challenge of our time, to not how hanging on to orthodox beliefs and adapting them to postmodern thought or modern science. The real is how we're going to live with other people, because now our world is divided, hideously divided, and the division, and often, sadly, religion has been implicated in some of the worst...
In a very central way, in a lot of ways.
Yes, I'd come back to that in a minute. I think that a lot of this is more due to politics, with religion getting sucked into rather than these conflicts being inspired by religion. I think most violent forms of religiosity that we're seeing at the moment have emerged in societies which have been where warfare and violence have become chronic. Middle East, Arab-Israeli conflict, a political conflict, secular conflict originally.
Given all that, are you optimistic that this is possible at all?
It has to be, or we won't save our planet. The challenge now is to live globally. We're living in one world, whether we like it or not. What happens today in Afghanistan or Iraq is going to have repercussions tomorrow in New York and Washington. We're living in a world bound together as never before, whether we like it or not. The Axial Age sages, something we haven't touched on yet, all insisted that we could not simply have compassion for our own group. We must cultivate what one of the Chinese sages called Jian Ai, concern for everybody, not omitting a single creature from our radius of concern. The Buddhists did this. Jesus told his followers to love their enemies. In Leviticus, Israelites are told to honor and love the stranger. And now we have to practice the golden rule globally and understand that nations, even those far away and remote and alien from us, are in every way as important as ourselves, and have to be. We must not do to them what we would not have done to ourselves.
My name is Arne Kislenko. I'm a historian. My specialty is the 20th century. But I've come here to Jerusalem because I want to find out what life was like in the first century. Look at this. A job that's still here after 2,000 years. Money changer. In this famous scene from the Gospels, Jesus sees the money changers in the temple. He overturns their tables and drives them out of the temple. Everybody's always been interested in the commotion Jesus caused. But I want to know what all these people were doing at the temple that day, and what they all did for a living. What were their jobs like, and what drove the economy? The hillsides around the city of Nazareth contain ruins that date back to biblical times. They've helped archaeologists and biblical scholars recreate what Nazareth would have looked like in Jesus' time. James Tabor, a biblical scholar specializing in the life of Jesus, is here to show me just how real it is. But listen, James, was Nazareth really like this?
I don't even think it could be reproduced, no matter what you did. Think about the crowdedness, the smells, the cacophony of sound.
The animals.
Animals walking around, the dung in the street.
I was thinking it must have stunk.
It would have to. We're going to go into one of the houses here. Notice as we step inside through the door, we're actually outside in this courtyard area, this workshop area.
Right.
90% of the life is outdoors, even though you're in the house with a bit of shelter from the sun. Think of all of these activities that go on in a village. Particularly the manufacturing, like somebody's going to be making the pottery, somebody's going to be baking the bread.
But everybody does that out of their house.
Out of their house. So it really gives you a sense of that workshop atmosphere. And here's an example of the weaving.
After shearing the sheep and washing the wool, the weaver does what's called carding the wool, opening it up and separating the fibers so they can work them on the loom.
That's been cleaned and worked on. How long does it take you to clean the wool? Like
3 months.
3 or 4 months. And
But there's another job they're doing in this house that I want to see, because it's one of the most famous jobs in the Bible, carpentry. We've all been told that when Jesus wasn't overturning tables, he was making them.
Is it common to have a small child in the workplace?
Absolutely. Judaism taught that if you don't train your son in a profession, you've abandoned him, basically.
We're in a carpentry shop, most famous job in the world. I mean, is this how Jesus would have grown up?
Yeah, I think that's the image people have. It's certainly in the movies and the books. But we've been studying the terms that are used, and Jesus is called a carpenter in English, but
right.
Of course it wasn't written in English, written in Greek.
Right.
But the word actually is tekton,
which means,
and it means sort of artisan or a builder, like a stonemason, which really doesn't fit woodworking as much.
Right.
So it could be any kind of builder. You notice there's not a lot of wood in a home,
right.
But more stone.
Lots of stone.
And most of the examples when Jesus taught, he talks about stone so often. Yeah, I think the carpenter idea is romantic in a certain way. A better image is getting up at 3 in the morning and heading off to Sepphoris nearby for hard labor at 4 or 5 in the morning, coming back near dark.
So, hot on the trail of the job that Jesus may have actually done, I'm heading off to the nearby town of Sepphoris. Because it's here, only 3 miles, but a world away from the village where he grew up, that Jesus may have gotten his first taste of the occupying power of Rome. This is James Strange, a world-renowned authority on biblical archaeology. He's been excavating Sepphoris for nearly 30 years, so he'll know why stonemasons in nearby Nazareth could have worked here in Jesus' time.
All the houses and buildings that you see over here to the left, that's Nazareth.
Right there.
That's right.
This is the economic center. So everybody from 18 miles around can come into this city and buy and sell. All the villagers, all the little hamlets, independent farmsteads, whatever they are. But also this city is in a major trade route that extends all the way to Italy and all the way to Egypt.
So it's a trade hub.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Would Jesus have come here?
When Herod the Great dies, this city revolts. And the Romans respond by destroying it. Then Herod the Great's son, Herod Antipas, inherits the city, so he gives orders that it be rebuilt. So thousands of workmen have to come in here. Someone has to cut the millions of stones that are in this mosaic floor.
Jesus very well could have come and worked here.
Jesus, his father, his brothers could all have been here.
That's incredible.
In Jesus' time, the Roman Empire ruled over Judea. Pagan Roman life, with its many gods and liberal ideas, was very different from how the Jewish people lived and how they prayed to one God. So the young Jesus lived right at the intersection of traditional Jewish culture and the urban life of the occupying Romans. He wasn't raised to live as the Romans did, but he may have built their houses.
It must have been
huge houses.
Oh, yeah, inside this building.
This is astonishingly big and Roman.
Even the administrators would be local people in the higher Rome.
So they get co-opted into the occupying.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So the Romans didn't just occupy. They influenced many of the Jewish people. Many of them were Hellenized or Romanized, absorbing Greek and Roman culture right here in the busy city of Sepphoris. So what was it like here?
The main road, it's absolutely teeming with life. People going everywhere. They're buying, they're selling. They're manufacturing. There'll be a laundry. You can go in there. This will be selling spices, and it'll be very aromatic.
It must have really smelled.
Oh, yeah. You bet it did. Think about a fresh fish shop, and you're walking right by it, you know, with all this fish, and the sun's been on a little while. And then also there are two drains underneath us on either side of the street, actually, and all kinds of sewage is running through there. So we're smelling fish. We're smelling sewage. We're smelling cinnamon, we're smelling perfume, we're smelling people. Depending on the prevailing winds, for example, you could be coming in from Tiberias and you could actually smell this city before you saw it. The ancients speak of that.
Now, I wanted to ask you, though, you know, I'm always fascinated by these little things. So, you know, what are the people wearing and how do they keep clean in a place like this?
Well, if they're wearing white, like they're a high-ranking person, then it has to be washed in urine. That's the Roman technology.
So it stinks.
It stinks. It's noisy, It's energetic. There's a lot of things going on.
So it's the Fifth Avenue of the ancient...
It's something like that, a Fifth Avenue in a major city right in the ancient world.
The Gospels tell us that when commerce threatened to take over the life of the temple, Jesus cracked the whip. And the seeds for that rage could have been sown here, at Sepphoris, where Jesus was likely getting his hands dirty while trying to keep his soul clean. Jesus' job leads him to where the work is, and his ideas and philosophy begin to develop with huge consequences.
This is how every day began in first century villages, with women making bread before dawn.
In the time of the Bible, the men went out early to work in the fields, but the women were up first, making a meal for them to take along. When it came to biblical jobs, women literally kept the home fires burning. If you didn't want to use sticks to create friction and heat, and if you didn't have a flint to create a spark, you kept the fire going at all times to heat your home and cook your meals. Food historian Tova Dickstein is an expert in the foods of ancient Israel. She's helping me to prepare your basic year one meal. I can't wait to see how it tastes.
Is it healthy? I mean...
Yeah, this is very healthy. Why? Because it's a complete nutrition. This is whole wheat.
Right.
Whole wheat with lentil. It's a complete protein. So simple.
It is
That's
very
the
simple.
Beauty of it. Yeah.
If we were living in biblical times, would this be all we'd ever eat?
No, this is the very basic ingredients, but people had more. Like vegetables, garden vegetables, fruit, olive.
This diet provided all the nutrition you would need for a hard day of work in the fields. Many of the jobs here were connected to the land. On the day the Gospels tell us Jesus overturned the money changers' table, some of the people in the temple were likely farmers. They would have come here to bring their first crops as an offering of thanks. With your life dependent on your crops and animals, you figure everyone would try and get along. But the Bible tells us that Adam and Eve had two sons. Cain was a farmer, and Abel was a shepherd. And we know how that turned out. Ronit Meoz is an expert in ancient Israeli studies. And she can tell us what agricultural jobs around here were like.
A farmer, of course, would look at the shepherd as something very, very low. But I think the shepherd would look at the farmer as being a prisoner because he's tied to his land.
So do you mean that farmers and shepherds would compete?
Are not friends, especially if you have those goats.
Beyond their use as food, in biblical times, goats were also used for temple sacrifices. These money changers that Jesus will confront are converting foreign currency. And one of the reasons pilgrims needed the local currency is so that they could buy animals to sacrifice in the temple. For the biblical farmer, the most important task was growing enough food for his family. Animals provided crucial help plowing the fields and growing staple foods. No wonder the Bible mentions animals so often. They were life and lifeline. Biblical farmers developed a terracing system still in use here.
Yeah.
They cut large shelves out of the hillside to prevent the soil from washing away. Here they grew barley and wheat and anxiously hoped they'd chosen the right amount of seeds to eat and to sow. From the time of the Bible right up to today, for the Jewish people, unless you've broken bread, you haven't had a meal. And in the Holy Temple, beyond the courtyard where the sacrifices were held, was the sanctuary. And the only food allowed in there was bread. But to grow the grains needed for your bread, you needed water. Being a biblical farmer meant looking to the skies and praying there would be enough rain. One of the toughest jobs was hauling water. And guess who did that?
Actually, you're now doing a typical woman's job, you know?
This is a woman's work.
Very hard work. Of course, very important, one of the hardest who will be given either to the women or to slaves.
Or university professors, too.
By the way, you know that it was a very hard job, but this is also the place of encounters. Women found their spouses
Really?
Yes. The most important encounters happen by a well or a cistern.
So this is like
all the important marriages.
This is the first century hangout.
This is the internet.
Yes. First century Facebook.
Of course, that's a matchmaking place here.
At the well, chance encounters led to many important biblical marriages. Moses and Zipporah, Jacob and Rachel, Isaac and Rebecca. I'm in Israel, learning about jobs in the time of Jesus. And there's a pretty important job you can't miss if you read the New Testament, because at least four of the disciples of Jesus were fishermen. So I've come north to the Sea of Galilee to find out why. This is Chaim Weitzman, a second-generation fisherman who grew up right here on the shores of the Galilee. We're going to fish where the disciples fished, and maybe find out the connection between this job and Jesus' earliest followers. So how did the disciples know where to find the fish? Like Chaim, they knew the waters around here, and they used their instincts. It didn't always work, but they had Jesus. And the Gospels tell us he miraculously knew where to find the fish. We're fishing for tilapia, which has been swimming in these waters since before the time of the disciples. Now, they call it St. Peter's fish, named after, guess who?
Very good.
Hey.
Yo-ho-ho!
Look!
Well, very nice indeed.
While Jim enjoys my expertly caught and brilliantly cooked St. Peter's fish, I ask him about the biblical fishing business.
First of all, you fish with nets. That's what's economical if you're trying to do something commercial. And then when you fish with nets in the ancient world, you fish at night because the fish can't see the nets at night. In order to keep your clothes from being ruined by the wash and bringing in nets and so on, you usually fish naked.
According to the writings of the first century eyewitness Josephus, the Galilee had a thriving economy with a salting factory to preserve fish for export. This was a good business. And in the nearby fishing village of Bethsaida, where many of the disciples came from, there's more evidence of how profitable the job fishing could be. Bethsaida is right on a major international trade route, the Via Maris. You've heard of the road to Damascus? Well, it starts down in Egypt and goes right through here.
This is the site of Bethsaida. It's a major city in Jesus' lifetime.
The image in my head of poor fishermen gets dispelled in Bethsaida, where archaeologists have discovered evidence of a middle-class lifestyle.
How do you know these were houses of the fishermen?
Well, because weights for fishing nets have been found here. They have actually found the bones of fish here. This is the courtyard of the house of the fishermen. And this is the wine cellar.
The wine cellar.
And this is what we need to find out if they're wealthy or not. Because all the houses look the same on the outside. It's what's on the inside that tells us their level of wealth. They found tall jars of the type that are used for wine. If they're collecting wine and going to a lot of trouble to corbel this over and to make a cool place, then they're trying to preserve a collection of wine.
Pretty wine.
Yeah, yeah.
You can store quite a lot then.
Yeah. So you don't express your wealth by decorating the house on the outside. You accumulate things on the inside that indicate your wealth.
What would this tell you about the life of fishermen around here?
Well, it tells us that they can accumulate a lot of capital, that they're really rather well off.
The disciples, they weren't poor?
They're fishermen. They might be fishermen contractors. You know, they might have a lot of boats out there, and they might be doing very well.
And they were better off than other tradespeople, basically.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Some of them lived here.
Yeah, some of them actually lived here. Came from Bethsaida. Peter and Andrew, particularly.
Right in this neck of the woods, isn't it?
Yeah, we could be looking at their houses and not knowing it.
You know, it makes sense that the disciples would have had well-paying jobs, because the Jesus movement is a rebellion, a revolution, and that takes cash as well as belief. We're seeing a transition between the Old Testament and the New, and jobs are one of the key differences. In the South, the farmers and shepherds of the Bible are at the mercy of the rain and the season. But in the North, the New Testament stories are all about fishing,
a year-round and stable business. All right, we've seen the nice guys in the nature. Who isn't happy to meet a farmer or a fisherman? They provide food. But there were guys who did another kind of job in Jesus' time, and everyone hated them. No one was happy to see them show up. And yet, it's a job that one of Jesus' own disciples did. In the first century, the Roman Empire ruled over Judea. But not only were the people colonized, they had to pay taxes to Rome. And what did the Romans do with all the money? Some of it went in to build places like this. This area has been inhabited for over 9,000 years. And no wonder. Two rivers converge here in the lush Jordan Valley, making for a plentiful water supply as well as rich soil. And its location also has strategic importance, as the road north from Jerusalem intersects here with the coast road from Lebanon. So I got to ask, I mean, how on earth would you pay for something like this?
Well, the simple word is taxes. And the Romans insist that conquered territories pay their own way as well as pay for this sort of massive building.
What kind of taxes are we talking about?
There are individual taxes per head, and there are property taxes. There are cuts into a certain percentage of produce. We think it might be anywhere from 30 to 50%. For the poor, it had to be truly oppressive. It wasn't graduated, so if it was 30% of a smaller amount, I mean, you could barely get enough to eat.
So when it comes to first century jobs, ruling over another country and collecting taxes from them is certainly one of the most profitable. In addition to all this splendor, which may not have interested the local workers who were paying for it, the Romans also used tax money to build roads and aqueducts, which did interest the locals. So there were mixed feelings towards the Roman conquerors and towards tax collectors. Not the most popular job then or now. But one of the disciples of Jesus was a tax collector, Levi, who was also called Matthew. With Jesus so opposed to Roman oppression, why did he have someone like this in his entourage? The Gospels tell us that Jesus is looking everywhere for sinners to repent. And I guess that includes tax collectors. Now we know how the IRS reacts if you don't pay your taxes. But what was it like in biblical times?
So what happens if there's a drought or a famine and you can't pay your taxes?
There's no mercy. You could go to jail. You could lose your land. You know, maybe you own a family plot of land and all of a sudden It's given over to some rich landowner.
And were people killed for this? Was there execution for not paying your taxes?
We do have examples of 2,000 people being crucified.
Really?
Up and down the road here in Galilee.
For not paying their taxes?
Because they joined an anti-tax revolution. Imagine seeing crosses up and down a Roman road.
Yeah, I'd start paying my taxes at that point.
That's exactly right.
Beyond your basic greed, the Romans also found that taxing everything and everybody dovetailed nicely with that other pillar of empire building, trade. Trade routes allowed them to tax goods at every stage of the journey. And it was merchants, another important job in the time of the Bible, who had to deal with both taxes and trade. Getting your wares to the big cities sometimes involved a great deal of travel, especially for certain goods that the city absolutely could not do without. For instance, in Jerusalem, they had to have frankincense. Without it, there could be no temple worship. Why not? What is frankincense anyway? And where does it come from? I've come to the Negev Desert to trace the frankincense trail and learn more about the men who couldn't do their jobs without it, the priests, the same men who clashed with Jesus. From this famous scene in the New Testament where Jesus overturns the money changer's table, I've been learning about the jobs all these people did in biblical times and how their professions could have brought them all to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem on that day.
There was another very important job practiced by those who were already at the temple, the priest. Priests were the link between the people and their God, performing animal sacrifices
and burning a special incense called frankincense as an offering. Frankincense begins as a tree resin from southern Arabia, but to get it to Jerusalem, it used to have to go through this. I'm in the Negev Desert, taking the same route the merchants and camel drivers took. And I'm here to meet Eunice Aburabeya and his herd of camels.
Salam alaikum.
This is my camel.
Okay.
What's his name?
Shailat.
Shailat.
Okay.
Shailat. The job of camel driver hasn't changed much in 2,000 years. The most important thing is to look after your animal, because we're a long way from anything. They're incredible animals, smarter than the vehicles that replace them. And unlike cars and trucks, they can go over almost any terrain.
Cover up my big head. Well, thank you very much.
Gamal yachol lakir makom ve'lo lishkoach oto. אם אנחנו לוקחים אותו לבאר מים והוא שותה, עוד שנה, שנתיים, הוא יכול לחזור לאותו מקום. יש לזה קרון, חבל על זה.
Bedouins always feed their guests. And if we were ancient merchants, we would certainly need to be fortified for the journey, taking frankincense through the desert to Jerusalem.
That is delicious.
Some people believe frankincense to be an effective anti-inflammatory, and current medical studies are testing other benefits. But the ancients knew that burning frankincense was an offering they had to make to God. It's still burned in churches today. And 2,000 years ago, pilgrims coming to Jerusalem and entering the temple would have inhaled its sweet fragrance. Three times a year, the Jewish people came to the temple from all over the world for the major festivals. The pilgrims brought animal sacrifices to the temple, but they didn't bring a goat or a dove with them halfway around the world. So the first thing they had to do was convert their currency so that they could buy animals to sacrifice. So what about this job, money changer? Did Jesus really object to it? After all, without it, pilgrims couldn't buy and offer their sacrifices. It wasn't the job. It was where the job was located. Inside the temple.
This crowded city of pilgrims attracted merchants of every kind. It was a good place for business. But Jesus didn't want the temple turned into a business, and some say the priests were allowing it to happen.
I want to find out more about this job, which was unlike any other, an answer to a boss unlike any other. In the pressure cooker of Jerusalem, how did these priests balance religion, commerce, Rome, and the first century rebel? In the time of the Bible, Jerusalem was as busy as it is today. Three times a year, pilgrims came from all around to offer sacrifices in the temple that used to be beyond this wall.
Jerusalem's pilgrims were great for local jobs, then and now. There were food vendors, there were hostel owners, and there were merchants of every kind. But, unlike today, there were thousands of priests who served in the temple.
These priests were in the temple to represent the people before their God, and nothing could interfere with them performing their holy functions. The most important functions were performed by the high priest. But under Roman occupation, there was plenty of interference with this job, and Rome made sure that the man it wanted was appointed. His duty was to God, but pleasing Rome allowed him to fulfill that duty. So he and the other priests had a delicate tightrope to walk. Shimon Gibson is a world-renowned biblical archaeologist who directs excavations in Israel. He can bring us closer to the lives of these men, for whom ritual purity was the key to being able to do their job.
So here you can see one of the gates which led into the temple area. This is the place where all the pilgrims who had been purified in the Siloam pool, and including the priests who had come from Napa City, would enter into the temple area.
So everybody comes right through here?
Exactly.
And it must have been a pretty chaotic scene if you've got all these people coming in. And
fairly chaotic, but you had a very, very strict administration.
How so?
And had the temple administrators. They would make sure that only those who had been purified in the pools were allowed into the temple.
Everyone had to immerse in a special pool, called a mikveh, before entering the holy temple. Its purpose was not for physical cleanliness, but for ritual purity. There were large mikvehs for the pilgrims, like this one, the Pool of Siloam, mentioned in the New Testament and recently discovered near where the temple stood.
And the water was on different levels, so whenever the pool was at a lower level, then you'd descend the steps. If the water was at a higher level, then you could remain close to the
top. So this went continually down like
all the way down to the bottom, and the steps were on all four sides, which was quite nice. So you've got to imagine almost like a theater with all these people sitting around, they've all come here in order to purify themselves before going up to the temple.
It was critical that priests become pure before entering the temple. One became impure by coming into contact with death. For instance, being in the presence of a dead body. And life's potential was sacred. So both the presence of semen that had not conceived, as well as menstrual fluid, required a trip to the mikveh. The priests believed that if they were impure when they entered the temple, everything they were trying to accomplish in the prayers for their people would fail. There were, and still are, strict rules about what kind of water could be used in a ritual bath. It couldn't be brought in by unnatural means. It had to be rainwater, or from a spring or river. Since nothing was more important than this ritual purity, some of the priests had their own private mikveh. But there's more to see as we descend further into history. Shimon is using geophysical mapping technology to see what hasn't yet been excavated. And he discovers something incredible at the lowest level of this house.
And lo and behold, in this area we found this hidden chamber with its ceiling still intact.
Oh, fantastic.
It's really amazing.
Oh, my.
You're in the cellar of the priestly house, and it's here that you have this mikveh, which is this ritual pool. If you came in from the marketplace, you might have brushed shoulders with a leper, which had made you impure. So if you're entering into the house, the first thing you did was you went to purify yourself in the mikveh.
Finding a mikveh in the home of a priest tells us just how crucial ritual purity was. It wasn't only in the temple. They needed to be pure everywhere they went in the city of God. When Jesus overturned the tables of the money changers, these priests would have felt that he was overturning their world. The delicate balance they had achieved between their God and the Romans. And here in his house, we can touch this man's life, this vanished job, temple priest.
This is extraordinary.
By doing their jobs, and finding out about their everyday lives, I've learned a lot about all the people who would have converged on the temple on a fateful day in the first century.
Join us next week when we continue to explore the Greco-Roman world that Jesus was born into, as well as the Judaism of his day. How did it get there? What were they thinking? What was the environment in which Jesus was born, grew up, taught, was crucified, and resurrected? We'd like to thank our sponsors, the Urantia Fellowship, for allowing us to air under the banner of God's Gumshoe. Under the banner of the Cosmic Citizen. The Cosmic Citizen is an interfaith program. Its main program runs on Saturday at 10 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio, Cosmic Citizen. Join us next week
and join the Cosmic Citizen, and we will explore further the developments that create the environment and the developments that created the Bible that we call the New Testament. Thank you. Bye now. Gumshoe out.